You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
I'm Julie Burstein in for Leonard Lopate on this rainy, chilly, gray day. According to my next guest, Dr. Deborah Davis, the war on cancer has used the wrong weapons to fight the wrong battles since it was launched 35 years ago. That's because researchers have focused on finding a cure for cancer, but for many reasons have neglected its causes. In The Secret History of the War on Cancer, Dr. Davis reveals that 10 million deaths from cancer could have been prevented if research that clearly linked cancer to exposures to toxins at work and at home had been heeded instead of hidden. Deborah Davis heads the country's first Center for Environmental Oncology at the University of Pittsburgh Cancer Center and is a professor of epidemiology at its Graduate School of Public Health. Her book is published by Basic Books, and I'm pleased that it brings Dr. Davis back to the Leonard Lopate Show today. Welcome.
Thank you so much.
At the beginning of this book, you mentioned that the book itself took you more than 20 years to write. Why? What took so long?
Well, the first time I tried to write this book, I had a snappy title called Cancer Wars, but it turned out to have been at the dawn of the Reagan Revolution, at a time when nobody was interested in hearing about how the government had a job to do to protect people from toxic substances and other things. And I went to my boss at the National Academy of Sciences at the time, and I said, hey, I've got this amazing book offer to write this book on what's gone wrong with the war on cancer. He got very quiet, and he said, it better be a good book. I said, well, they think it will be. You know, they're offering me a nice advance. He said, it had better be a really good book. I said, I don't understand. He said, well, I'm not telling you what to do, but given what's going on right now, if you write a book like that, you won't be able to work here when you finish. In fact, he was right. That was not the right time to write a book critical of the cancer enterprise and its focus on finding and treating cancer. Now, in fairness, we have made tremendous progress. There are 10 million cancer survivors today. Breast cancer is a survivable disease. Prostate cancer, testicular cancer, as Lance Armstrong shows us. We have 10 million cancer survivors. That means we're doing something right, but the reality is if we only get better at treating cancer and finding it, and we don't deal with the upstream causes of it, we'll never really make enough progress against this disease. And we know that there are many causes of cancer that we should have acted on earlier. That's how I calculate there were 10 million avoidable deaths.
You know, that story that you just told seems almost like a metaphor for many of the stories you tell here, which is people, passionate scientists who tried to look at the causes for cancer and then were told, okay, you've done that, but let's not tell anybody.
Or oftentimes information, you have to understand, in the days before the internet, there wasn't public access to information. The internet, as the Chinese government understands, is the ultimate democratizing institution. And with information, people have the ability to make changes in their lives. And that's why we're talking now about this book. That's why this book is getting the reception that it's getting, because it's full of very practical things you can do to reduce your risk that we tell you about at our center at preventingcancernow.org as well. There are things you can do. This is not all doom and gloom.
Is this a common story in the history of medicine of people looking to try to fix something before they look to figure out why it happened in the first place? I think about childbirth fever, where the man who thought, all right, let's wash our hands before we let women have babies, was ridiculed.
Well, Semmelweis, who was the fellow who figured that out, was more than ridiculed. He was really hounded out because he was saying that doctors themselves were responsible for women dying because they were going from one birth to another with hands not being washed and therefore transferring bacterial infections, which we now understand, of course, was the case. Often in medicine, people who come up with new ideas are ridiculed. That's a kind of pretty hot litmus test that can be applied. And sometimes people have wrong ideas. But in this situation, where it comes to understanding the environmental and industrial causes of cancer, the slope has been very slippery. The burden of proof has been unduly steep. And oftentimes, information has remained locked and hidden in industry files because they could do that back then. It was absolutely common for industry to say, come and study us, and then we'll let you know if you get to publish your results. That was the way people operated well into the 1960s and 70s in the United States.
You write about, in ways this book looked read like a detective story in many cases, and you write about having someone tell you about a conference in the 1930s that happened where all of the cancer researchers from around the world gathered, but you hadn't really heard of this.
Never imagined that in 1936, the world's on the brink of war, and 200 of the world's top scientists travel by boat and train to Brussels, where they exchange the latest scientific information on the things known at that time to cause cancer, which included asbestos and benzene and hormones and diagnostic radiation and sunlight, and they warned that tars and soots and mining would increase the risk of cancer. And the data that they used then was animal information with cell culture studies with whole animals. They also had information on what we nowadays would call epidemiologic studies of patterns of disease in workers. So they were aware of these risk factors in 1936, and I was astonished at the sophistication of that information, which is available on the website for the book as well, because it really raised the question of what happened.
Well, that was what I was going to ask. Okay, so this is 70 years ago. What happened after that?
Well, you have to understand the world really was on the brink of World War II in 1936. And the country that had been the world's leader in science up to that time had been Germany. The fact that a lot of the evidence on the dangers of the workplace and the environment came from Germany certainly didn't help for that evidence to be treated seriously. Then, as I tell in my book, we had major corporations in the United States that collaborated with the Germans, the Italians, and the Japanese to develop the ways that they were able to fight war against Americans. So Ethyl Gemeinschaft was a company formed by the Ethyl Company in the United States with its German partners, and they worked to secure the safe production of leaded gasoline for Germany, Japan, and Italy. And after the war, documents began.
During the war, they worked.
Prior to and then during the war, of course, Ethyl Gemeinschaft, as a German company, continues to operate. The War Department in the United States asked the American company not to give the formula for leaded gasoline to the Germans. And I have records in my book of how the company said they wouldn't, but in fact did give them the formula. And after the war, a fellow named Harry Truman, who was then a senator, found out about this collaboration. And there were hearings, and people did say, wow, this was not a good idea. But it's like we forget this message. What happened for the world's scientists then was that they had to take a back seat, understandably, to the fact that people were fighting for their lives. Once that mentality of terror really, really seeped into scientific consciousness, then the idea that we should really not worry about the long term was a very logical consequence. Because after all, if you think you're going to die tomorrow, then you don't think about what's going to happen 20 or 30 years later when cancer might develop.
Whether something you're doing right this moment might lead to something when you're 60 or 70 or 80.
And unfortunately, that approach to life is with us now in some ways as well, that when we are afraid and terrorized by immediate threats to our lives, then the long-term issues, whether it's the long-term issues of people who were around the tragedy of the World Trade Center or the long-term issues of people who are cleaning up a hazardous waste site downstream of a munitions factory, those issues really recede, and the most important thing is survival from one day to the next.
When I was reading your book, I thought a lot about the World Trade Center and what we're learning now and what we didn't know then, and also about one of the issues that seems to come up over and over again, which is the issues of how things happen are very complex, and so often they're pushed to the side just because people don't know how to synthesize all of these different ideas.
And just because something is complicated doesn't mean that we can't understand it and doesn't mean that we can't take prudent action to try to reduce risk. I mean, just as a simple example, asbestos has been known for many, many years to be dangerous. The United States and Canada are two of the only industrial countries not to have banned asbestos. Most people think we have. Right now, there's a bill in committee in Congress that supposedly bans asbestos, and it's being weakened as we talk right now by behind-the-doors manipulations to try to get exemptions for various uses of asbestos, even at this very moment. The Canadians are still exporting asbestos to India, where children are exposed to it and using it in conditions that are unsafe. And there is a call for a worldwide ban on asbestos, but the United States and Canada are not joining in that call at this time.
I'm speaking with Dr. Deborah Davis, who has written a book called The Secret History of the War on Cancer. It's from Basic Books. And you talk about asbestos. I drive through Manville occasionally in New Jersey and see an area that's now a Walmart and a variety of other things, knowing that that's where the Johns Manville plant was, and knowing the history of the industrial fight against acknowledging that asbestos was a problem. You've been talking now about the difficulties for scientists that come from governmental issues and the difficulties that come from industry. You also talk about scientists, though, who have been willing to push through that.
Right.
One of the stories that you write about is about a scientist who was fired from Mobil, I think, for exposing the information about what was going on there.
Dr. Myron Melman was the chief of toxicology for Mobil, which is, as you know, one of the top companies in the world. He went to Japan, and he warned in the 1980s that the amount of benzene in their gasoline was so high it was dangerous. And they said, but we can't change it. And he said, well, you shouldn't be producing it then. By the time he returned to his office at Mobil headquarters in New Jersey, he'd been fired. This was after a distinguished career there, where he'd just received a promotion and a salary increase months earlier. But because he was a prominent scientist and had been nominated to be a member of the National Academy of Sciences, he sued the company under the New Jersey Whistleblower Protection Act. And his lawsuit was settled for millions of dollars. He has turned over to me the files that he was able to keep. Many of them he did not have, showing how Mobil was aware of the dangers of benzene and gasoline. Gasoline and diesel fuel clearly cause cancer. They contain ingredients like benzene, like butadiene, that are proven to cause cancer in humans. We need to be smarter and understand children should not be pumping gas. We all should take precautions to make sure we're standing upwind and not downwind. And we have to recognize that there are some modern hazards we can't completely avoid, but we want to minimize our exposure to them. And Dr. Melman was very courageous in giving me those materials. There are other scientists whom I can't tell you the name of who've also given me materials showing dangers of things that they worked with in other companies. And right now, the thing that's exciting to me is that green is the new black in the business world. The fastest growing sector of most multinational companies is the part that's going green. Archer Daniels Midland has a component now that's making bioplastics, not growing corn for fuel, which I think is a foolish idea, but taking agricultural waste, the stuff you'd have to throw away, and turning it into plastic cups. At the University of Pittsburgh Medical Center, when you go to get a drinking cup, it's made out of corn byproducts. Now, you can't eat it, but it's not going to be, it's going to degrade in a landfill naturally. It's much less toxic to the workers who produce it. It doesn't release things into the food that you're drinking out of it.
You mentioned Dr. Melman, and you mentioned the scientists who you can't name. What do you think allows someone like a Dr. Melman to stand up and say, you know what, this benzene, this is really dangerous, you have to stop this? Understanding, as I would assume he did, that this could be very dangerous for him.
I think at the time, frankly, you have to remember, there was a certain naivete, and I think I confess to being naive myself in that sense, or idealistic, if you will. I believe he thought that the company would do the right thing. I don't think he was trying to be suicidal there. And there are people in these major companies who are talking to me now who do want to do the right thing. And there are leaders of the corporate world that are trying to do so. The Equator Principles have just been signed off on by many of the Fortune 50 companies. This is a commitment to make investments that are not going to degrade the environment. Now, that's pretty revolutionary. We'll see what it really means, but at least the language has changed. Whether they walk the talk, at least they're starting to talk it,
which is a new thing.
Yes.
I'm speaking with Dr. Deborah Davis. She has written The Secret History of the War on Cancer. It's from Basic Books, and we will be right back. I'm Julie Burstein. I'm here for Leonard Lopate, and I'm with Dr. Deborah Davis, who has written The Secret History of the War on Cancer. And if you're online right now and you'd like to see something that Dr. Davis and her colleagues have put together. It's the 12 things you can do to avoid cancer, and that's at our website at WNYC.org. Dr. Davis, how many people are diagnosed with cancer in the United States each year? Do we know?
Yes, we know. It's about 1.5 million.
1.5 million.
But that includes skin cancers as well. So the numbers, one of the interesting things is that our national registry doesn't reflect all of those. In terms of the major deaths in the United States, we're dealing still with big numbers. But the good news is cancer deaths are falling.
So the diagnosis of cancer is on the rise, but the deaths from cancer are falling, or is the diagnosis about the same as it
Well,
once
actually,
was?
The even new cases of breast cancer, prostate cancer, colorectal cancer are falling. Right? And we think that this is because screening programs have really started to work. Now, we don't know whether some of the decline is because we actually are not doing as much screening in mammography right now because of some of these federal cuts that we've seen. They have big effects across the board. But it looks like there's a real downturn, and that would be consistent with what some of us warned and noted in the 1980s, which is that the amount of workers in the blue-collar workforce is now at the lowest point in American history. We have fewer men and women who are working in dirtier jobs than at any point in history. As a result, the contribution of occupational cancer to the national toll may be less overall, but for workers who are exposed, it may be very high. For example, African Americans have higher risks of many forms of cancer. 1 in 8 Americans is black. 1 in 2 who works in sanitation is black. 1 in 3 who works in a dirty factory job is black. Now, African Americans tend to eat poorer diets, higher in animal fat, higher in preservatives, but they also tend to live and work in dirtier environments. Nobody is asking now about the role of those things for their poorer health, although our Center for Minority Health at the University of Pittsburgh Graduate School of Public Health has just begun a series of projects that we hope will clarify that question.
And location can affect one's risk of cancer. I know there's been studies done of the South Bronx where people live, where there's more of a collection of the various industries that create the kinds of things that could expose you to risk for cancer.
Yes, indeed. And Professor Frederica Pereira of Columbia University has done some brilliant work where they put backpack monitors on young pregnant women in the Bronx and Harlem and have followed them throughout their pregnancies. And they have found that when their babies are born, the amount of pollutants in their blood is associated with the smaller head size and lower birth weight of the babies that they bear. And their pollution comes not from working in factories that are in the South Bronx, but just from living and working in an area that has a very high diesel exhaust and a high concentration of industry.
You yourself have had experience with cancer through your family. You write very movingly about both your mother and your father who wrestled and finally succumbed to cancer. And both of them had experiences when they were very young. You talk about the head size of babies. Talk a little bit about your father's experience as a toddler.
My father's family emigrated from Europe, and they owned a dry cleaning shop that they operated in the basement of their home. When my dad was a toddler, it blew up. They were using benzene to clean the clothes. And even then, in 1920s, benzene was illegal because it was known by scientists to cause cancer and be very dangerous.
It was illegal, yet his family was able to get some and use it for their dry cleaning business.
It's a very effective solvent. It slices right through everything, including dirt and bones and skin. So my grandmother, who I didn't know this story about her until she died, went into the burning building and rescued both of the children who were in there. Otherwise, I would never be here. My grandmother rescued them. My father went on to be a chemist and a machinist working in the mills as a teenager. And as a chemist and a machinist back in those days, he worked with a lot of cutting oils and solvents and benzene and other things. It won't surprise some people who know me well that my father was also a drill sergeant.
And is that something you have you've inherited from him? Is that focus on keeping things in order?
Well, I think there may be. I also love to sing certain Army drill songs, but keeps you going, keeps you moving, and you know you need to stay focused on things, and you need to do things one at a time. But among the things that happened to him as part of his experience in the military was that he would have repeated chest x-rays, with fluoroscopes. After World War II ended, they would drive around trucks and they would be screening people for tuberculosis. Understandably, tuberculosis was a serious problem. People didn't fully understand the risks of diagnostic radiation. So my father had lots of diagnostic radiation. He had exposure to solvents. He worked in the mills of Donora, the town I came from, where people dropped dead from air pollution in 1948. My mother, I think, grew up, of course, in the same area, but her cancer most likely came about from an overuse of diagnostic radiation. She had three bypass operations. She had several angiograms. She had back surgery repeatedly. And each time in the 1970s and 80s that she experienced this, she would have massive amounts of radiation to her body. So the cancer that she developed at the end might well have been caused by some of these medical techniques. The American College of Radiology is so concerned about the excessive use of diagnostic radiation today that they've issued a white paper in which they say that the annual use of medical radiation today in the United States is equal to that released by the Chernobyl explosion into the upper atmosphere throughout the world. And they call for reducing unnecessary diagnostic radiation and for major summit meetings with emergency room physicians, pediatricians, and others who often aren't aware of how much diagnostic radiation can be involved. So in the case of my parents, there were many different things that contributed to the fact that they each ultimately developed cancer.
That figure that the American radiologists have put out about the amount of radiation that Americans are receiving through diagnostic procedures is equals, in 1 year, the amount released in Chernobyl is a chilling, chilling figure. And I, as I read it, thought as a parent, there have been moments where our pediatrician has said, I think your child has pneumonia. We need to give him a chest X-ray. And that's happened a number of times in our young children's lives. And I look back at that and think, are there other ways of analyzing these sorts of things? Or, you know, these are tools that doctors use and depend on. How do we know when they're being used for the right thing or when they're being used a little bit too much?
Well, Julie, let me be clear. A single chest X-ray when pneumonia is suspected is entirely appropriate. I'm talking about CT scans, and most people don't realize a computerized tomographic scan, a CT scan, can be hundreds to thousands of chest X-ray equivalents. Now, if your child shows up in the emergency room unconscious with a bleeding head, they may need a CT scan. But that's quite different from a single chest X-ray. And certainly, I'm not a physician. I'm not advocating what should be done in any individual circumstance. But the American College of Radiology and the pediatric radiology community is very concerned about the unnecessary use of higher doses of radiation. Because the thing about CT and PET scans is they're magnificent in terms of the quality of the images you can get. And the higher the dose of radiation, the better the image. So you can avoid surgery by using this technology. And that's obviously a good thing. But one needs to look at the total picture, and in some circumstances, magnetic resonance imaging and ultrasound may be appropriate. The decision about what is needed has got to be made by a medical professional. My position, which the American College of Radiology is consistent with, is that physicians need to be better informed about the trade-offs involved here. And I think that once we achieve that, there we will see a reduction in CT scans, particularly given to children and infants.
In reading your book, as I read through the various chapters, I felt like there were all of these Pandora's boxes that kept being opened, that something like benzene is found to be able to be an extraordinary solvent, and it's only later that you realize there are real risks to that. And something like cell phones, which you write about at the end of the book, is something that's transformed life in the United States, definitely, but there are questions about what other things might this bring with it.
And I think for cell phones, I cannot tell you that they are dangerous, and I cannot tell you that they are safe, and no one else can either. That's part of the dilemma we have with modern technology. What we do know is this: today's cell phones are safer than ever. Okay, but they could become more safe. There's a new report called the Bioinitiatives Report that can be found, a link from our website, which reviews evidence from dozens of world's experts on this issue. It's 600 pages long. And it clearly lays out what we do know and what we don't know about cell phones and cell towers. You're right. We save lives. Those amazing phone calls people were able to leave at 9/11, they're priceless to the family members who have the last messages from people. What I advise is that you do not keep your cell phone on and on your body all day, that you use it with a speakerphone, with a wired headpiece, with a hollow tube at the end, or with a Bluetooth. Those are ways of minimizing your exposure. I advise, as does the German government, the British government, and the government of Bangalore, India, that children not use cell phones except for emergencies. I understand we have a great marketing here.
So I stand in the schoolyard yesterday, and I see my 9-year-old's 10-year-old friend with his cell phone talking to his babysitter. And so those are things that you would recommend not happen.
The skull of children is much more penetrable than that of you or me. And we know from the manufacturer's own evaluations that the microwave signal from a cell phone held to the head does penetrate the brain. Children's brains are continuing to develop. They're hot enough. We don't have to heat them anymore. And I think that we are overusing cell phones, and we have understudied the risks. There has never been a single study on cell phones and their damage, their impact on children. And a recent analysis in Sweden has found that people who use cell phones for 10 years or more have double the risk of brain cancer. Now, I don't think we ought to wait for that to develop. We want to continue to have the electrical engineers design our phones so that they have as little exposure as possible. And we want to reduce our direct head radiation by using earpieces and speakerphones.
In your book, Dr. Davis, one of the things that I noted is that You have a lot of the epidemiological research, you have a lot of tables, but you also really focus on the individuals who have fought this war on cancer over the past 70 years or more. Why, as a writer, did you decide that you would spend as much time giving us a sense of who these people are as talking about the work that they've done?
Because I think it's important for people to understand scientists are humans just like the rest of us, and we make mistakes. And some of them, one of my heroes is Leon Bradlow. Dr. Bradlow has been working for close to 40 years trying to figure out good and bad hormones, trying to come up with what I think will lead to a blood or urine test to predict who's going to get breast cancer so we can intervene long before the disease develops. He's an unsung hero. He's been working with a few colleagues, and because the results of his test are not likely to make anybody really rich, it's been very difficult for that work to be widely appreciated. Other people I talk about in the book I can't name, like the engineer, the young engineer who came to tell me about watching contamination in the area near the coke ovens of Pittsburgh in the 1980s, where they drilled a test well with a 50-millimeter thick polyvinyl chloride pipe, and when they came back the next day, it had dissolved.
The pipe had dissolved.
And when they came back the day after that, a cement platform was covering the area they had sampled, so they were never able to get further answer to the question.
One of the things as a reader that struck me was there are people who are continuing to try to do the right thing. Some of them, though, get derailed and end up suppressing the information that would be helpful to the rest of us.
Well, that's why I think this is a new day. I am now working for a major corporation. The University of Pittsburgh Medical Center is in many states, it's in many countries, and it's going green. Now, what does that tell you? If a major health system is going green, we have reduced infection in our hospital by a number of practices. We're using microfiber mops. What has mop got to do with cancer? Those mops use half as much water, half as much chemicals, and you change the head with each room. When you change the mop head, you're not transmitting infection from A to B to C. That's the kind of thing that we're doing that's also reducing the amount of discharge into our local waters, reducing the amount that can get into our local fish, and ultimately making our workers and patients safer. And that's what's happening all over the world. As Thomas Friedman has written, green is the new red, white, and blue.
So it sounds like the book is a cautionary tale. There are a lot of things that have happened over the past century that we're only now understanding what the repercussions are. But from hearing you talk now, it sounds like you have a bit of a more optimistic view of what may happen next.
Oh, absolutely. I think for cancer patients and for the rest of us, hope is the most important drug. It's the most important thing for us to hold on to. And the fact that I'm sitting here talking to you now and that this book is being widely discussed on radio, that I'm able to find people like you who really understand these issues, I think that tells us the world has changed.
One of the things we talked about earlier is the whole idea of complexity. And I can imagine for young scientists today, they go into the work and say, where do I begin? You end the book with a quote from a rabbi, Rabbi Tarfon. Can you talk a little bit about that?
I certainly can, but let me also say that what happens in science is sometimes we know more and more about less and less because we drill down and drill down into more and more specific issues and fail to see the big picture. Well, there's a story from the Talmud of a group of workers that's told, listen, you've got this job to do and get going. And they say, this is crazy. We don't have the right tools. The task is enormous. We'll never, ever get it done. This is impossible. And the reply of the rabbi is, it's not for you to finish the job, but you must begin it.
One of the other things that I felt as I read the book, maybe it's my own propensity to catastrophize, but as I read it, I became more and more nervous about my child's x-rays, about whether there's aspartame in the food that we're eating, about cell phones. What do you say to people who may read this book and think, okay, what can we do in the world without increasing our risk of cancer?
As a Chinese proverb says, a long journey begins with a single step. And what you can do is you start with the things that you bring into your home, put on your body, and use for your family. We know that dogs whose homeowners use lawn chemicals die 4 times more often of lymphoma. So we can start reducing the use of toxic materials in our immediate environment. We can start with the programs that Governor Pataki started to reduce the use of pesticides in schools. Those are good steps. And again, green businesses are booming because people understand that they can do more with less. You can deal with ants with red pepper spray. There's red pepper, not spray, but just pepper flakes.
Right, right.
There's very many simple things you can do. And the other thing about this, which we're doing at the University of Pittsburgh Research Centers, we're doing research on chemo prevention. If you take an extract of broccoli, you can get ovarian cancer cells to die. My colleague Shivendra Singh has done that work. We're doing work at the Center for Environmental Oncology where we're looking at materials related to yogurt and getting that to affect and enhance the ability to get lung cancer cells to die. So there's a lot of evidence from nutrition that what you eat can be very, very effective. And you'll see some people focusing on the fact that there are carcinogens in food. Sure, there are carcinogens in food that occur naturally, but you eat food as a mixture. That strawberry, that peanut butter sandwich is full of fiber and antioxidants and ellagic acid and good things for you that will have a beneficial effect. The good news story, and there is good news, out of the hormone replacement therapy literature is this. Within 2 years of the population reducing its use of hormone replacement therapy, it looks like breast cancer actually falls. Now, if that's true, what is it telling us? It's telling us that late-stage exposures to something like hormone replacement therapy actually make a difference in whether or not you get cancer. If that's true, then it's saying that you're not doomed by whether or not you've eaten something that's a carcinogen in your food naturally. And the things that happen later on in life with synthetically added materials like hormone replacement therapy will make a difference. So even at this stage of life, if you have cancer or you're trying to avoid it, cleaning up your act and getting rid of the things you can control will make a difference.
Dr. Davis, thank you so much.
You're very welcome.
Dr. Davis is the author of The Secret History of the War on Cancer that is just out from Basic Books. Thank you again.
Thank you, Julie.